Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Extra Point Podcast. Today is Tuesday, March 17th. My name's Todd Stiles, one of the pastors at First Family Church. Glad you're listening in today. Thanks for being a part of the audience of the Extra Point Podcast. Really glad to know people listen. I love the questions we get, love the conversations we have throughout the week about the podcast. And of course, the podcast always flows from the text from which we preached the previous Sunday. And that's true for this week again, as we are going to bring some more insight, some additional observation and perspective regarding Exodus chapter 5 through about verse 7 of chapter 7. I have two questions in mind from some of our congregants. So let me just kind of address those and bring some further observation to these two or so chapters. Now, as you know, this set of verses, chapter 5, verse 1 through about chapter 7, verse 7, it's the final section in what we're calling the first movement of Exodus. We have kind of divided Exodus up into three movements. This is the first movement. And someone asked me, why did you split it at chapter 7, verse 7? It seems like an odd place, they said. You know, we've been talking a lot about how the first movement is really about God's call to Moses, more of a private type of individual, personal section. It goes really public with Egypt and Pharaoh in the next section. But this person did point out that it seems like it went kind of public already in chapter 5 when he goes to Pharaoh. So why the division in chapter 7, verse 7? It's a really good question. And let me provide my perspective and why I chose to divide it there. If you'll notice that in chapter 6, verse 30, which is the last of chapter 6, Moses does give another, we'll call it objection or response. You could even say complaint. He shows a little bit of resistance still to this calling upon his life to be Israel's deliverer and to be the one to go to Pharaoh and to say, on behalf of Yahweh, let my people go. So that's Exodus 6, verse 30, and then chapter 7, the first few verses are really some information about Moses and Aaron, their age and so forth, and it just kind of shows that this is now what's going to happen. And from that point forward, from Exodus 7, verse 8, through the end of the book, there's not another time that Moses gives an explicit objection to his calling. Now, that isn't to say that Moses doesn't have some frustrating moments. We know he does. But it's not about his calling. It's not about the mission, his assignment. It's more about, let's say, the people. He's frustrated with perhaps the demands of leadership. There are times, he has pretty intense conversations with the Lord about his job, so to speak. But he never questions his calling again after chapter 7, verse 7. And so for that reason, I think the private individual aspects end. And I put that around 7-7. You could have put it in 6-30, but I think the most sensible paragraph break was in 7-7. That's when we see that Moses, I believe, finally is resolved in God's calling upon his life and his mission, and he's on board, and he never again brings up a question about his calling. It's the last explicit objection about his assignment. Like I said, he does voice some struggles later, but again, they're not about his calling. He's frustrated with the people. There is some anger and disobedience at a later incident, which is chronicled for us in Numbers 20. But after Exodus chapter 7, verse 7, Moses is the obedient leader. He doesn't continue to bargain or negotiate with God at all. His reluctance really dissipates, and he embraces this mission from God. And so for that reason, I have placed the first division to end at 7-7. And here, everything does go public, and Moses no longer questions his assignment from the Lord. Next, let me just deal with what I mentioned in the message, the six I will statements in the CSB translation, versus the seven I will statements that's in most, if not all, of the other translations. I think there may be a Jewish study Bible that also goes with six, but there is a distinct difference between the CSB, which has six I will statements, and then the New King James, the King James, the ESV, the NASB, the NIV, the majority of other translations, in fact, all of them, I believe, render it with seven. And so I mentioned this in the message because I knew that some of you may be using a different translation or version than I use, which is the CSB currently. And so I didn't want you to wonder like, hey, Todd, did you miss one? I've got seven. You're preaching about six. And so I mentioned to you that there is a difference. I said I'd explain more on today's podcast. So I want to do exactly that and tell you exactly how perhaps the CSB team arrived at that, maybe where I land on it personally. The reason they got to six, and I alluded to this in the message, the reason that the CSB goes with six I will statements is simply this. They combine the first two verbs, and they see them as tightly connected. In fact, they see them as a pair that describes one action. And sometimes in the Hebrew language, you know, verbs are paired to intensify one idea because they're not trying to describe separate events. And in this case, of course, the first two verbs, they do mean that Israel, the Hebrews, were brought out from under the burdens of the Egyptians and they were delivered from slavery. And so it appears that some CSB translators judge that these two verbs, they really function like parallel descriptions of one event, which it would be liberation. They're not necessarily two distinct promises. And so that's why it reads, I will bring you out and rescue you. And so they see it as one, and they insert one I will statement, which is in the text, and they take the second I will, which is right before the word rescue in the Hebrew text, and they simply include that in the first one. So there's only six I will statements in the CSB. They present these two separate promises as one unit. We may call it one compound promise, so to speak. Now, this is because the CSB follows what we call optimal equivalence. And so that would be a balance, let's say, between formal equivalence, which is word-for-word accuracy, and then there's also functional clarity, which is looking for the most natural meaning in English words. There's different ways to express this. You can call it dynamic equivalent as well. That would be the opposite of formal equivalence. One's a word-for-word accuracy. One's more like conceptual accuracy. Optimal equivalence would be something trying to that strikes a balance between the two. And so it appears here that perhaps if the Hebrew language is stacking the verbs, then perhaps this would be a good way to reach optimal equivalence. But if you actually are trying to find formal equivalence, which is word-for-word accuracy, then understanding it as seven I will statements would really be the best way. You'd be preserving every single noun and verb in this section. Now, I don't think the CSB is denying the presence of seven verbs. I think they're simply saying the first two are really more like a poetic pair. They're describing the same stage of salvation, so to speak, the same stage of rescue. I personally, however, like sticking with seven promises. I think that fits not only the actual formal language, what's in the technical text, to be honest with you, but I think there's a poetic reason as well. I tend to see this section and this moment, these covenant promises, as a moment that Moses, as the author, not only lists for us these seven promises given by Yahweh, seven I will statements, but he also seizes an opportunity to do it in a poetic fashion. And so he does so using the number seven, because seven is the biblical and Hebrew number for completion, for perfection. And so could it be that Moses is not only in a literal way writing down seven of the I will statements, but then poetically showing us that this is exactly who God is. He's in a very poetic fashion picturing God's perfection and completion through the number seven, as well as helping us see them in written form. So I tend to think seven would have been a better choice and a better option. I like it that way because it pictures it poetically and it lists it clearly, succinctly, decisively. Seven I will statements that God did fulfill, that he did accomplish, and that's because that's who he is. He is a God of completion and perfection and fulfillment. So in the Hebrew text, there are actually seven verbs, and they describe what God will do. But one English translation, at least, the CSB, they combine the first two because they sense that describes one stage of the liberation the Hebrews experienced, God bringing them out from under Egypt's oppression. And here's what I want to say to you. Either way, the point's the same. And so I don't think we have an issue of integrity. We don't have some kind of error at all. We just have a different choice in translation. Because either way, here's what's happening. God is piling promise upon promise upon promise to assure Moses and his people that redemption is moving forward. Now, we know that the CSB has gone from 7 to 6, and their reasoning, did you know that these 7 I will statements also form for us the basis for the 4 cups of the Passover? In the traditional Jewish Seder, participants drink 4 cups of wine, and each of those cups, they are connected to a specific promise here in this very passage, Exodus 6, 6 through 8. Let me just list those cups for you because we'll see that, yes, there are 7 I will statements. If you combine the first 2 verbs, you could come up with 6. Here, the rabbis have chosen to summarize all of them into 4 cups so that each generation, in an ongoing fashion, remembers God's work. It's the cup of sanctification. It's the cup of deliverance, the cup of redemption, and the cup of praise, sometimes called the cup of restoration. And so, again, we're seeing ways in which the 7 I will statements can be looked at and seen in various ways. And this is not at all to say we can change scripture or we can adjust what's in God's word. We're not saying that at all. But let's narrow in even a little more and go to the number 3 for something, because in Exodus 6, verses 2 through 8, we really see a 3-stage covenant structure. And so this is really beautiful as well. We see covenant identity in verses 2 through 5, in which he mentions his name, I am the Lord. And of course, this is throughout the text, but especially there. We see covenant redemption. That's a stage we looked at. Verses 6 and 7. And of course, it concludes with covenant fulfillment. And so you could see this section in 3 stages: the stage of covenant identity, the stage of covenant redemption, and the stage of covenant fulfillment. So, just giving you some other ways to see this section and let you know that, yes, I prefer probably the 7 I will statements as the most literal, most formal. But from that, you can preach this in different ways. I chose to preach it from the text we were using, the translation we were using, the CSB. We could have approached this text through a 3-stage development. We could have looked at it through 4 cups. There's other ways even. Just know this, that regardless of your preference or maybe how the translation should occur or even how the emphasis should occur in your reading or preaching of it, it does all point to one thing. God here is declaring who he is and what he will do. And at every turn, both then and now, God will keep his word. He is a God of complete dependability, 100% faithfulness, trustworthiness. And that's the God we trust today as we await his second coming. And so, my fellow brother and sister, let's long for the Lord's appearing. And let's live with certainty. He is coming again.
Thanks for listening to the Extra Point Podcast. To find more content and resources to grow deeper in your relationship with Jesus, go online to firstfamily.church/resources.